Hi, everyone. The history of standardized tests and assessment exams reflect an ongoing balancing act of local autonomy and state or national control over what happens in the classroom. Advocacy for standardized tests dates back to the mid-1800s, but certainly gained prominence through legislation such as the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, No Child Left Behind, and the Every Student Success Act. While exams were initially used to evaluate teaching effectiveness, they have transitioned to high-stakes processes generally tied to allocations of state and federal funding. Because of this, improvement in test scores is a prominent goal for most districts, and we'll be talking about one approach for doing that on today's Teaching Matters.
Welcome to Teaching Matters, a podcast exploring all things teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. And here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University.
Thank you, Trinity. Joining me today is Mukunda Krishnaswamy, the founder and CEO of Lumos Learning. Mukunda's career has focused on innovation in the technology sector, including founding two companies. Also joining is Dr. Richard Katz, Senior Superintendent in Residence at Lumos. Richard has served in a variety of administrative roles, including both principal and superintendent positions in the Northeast prior to joining Lumos. Lumos Learning is a company that was founded in 2007 and assists students in preparing for state assessment exams. Gentlemen, thank you both for giving me your time today. I appreciate it.
Scott, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having us.
So, Mukunda, I would like to start with you as the founder of the company. Clearly, you know, in looking at your resume and your background, you have a significant amount of experience in innovation and technology and entrepreneurship. What was it that led you into the education sector and, you know, your motivation for founding Lumos in the first place?
So, interestingly enough, I had zero background in education, publishing, other than the fact that I did go to school for many years, but not to be a teacher. This was a personal problem for me. I have two boys. My older one, when he took the state test for the first time in New Jersey, like many parents, I was like, oh, I had to do something about this. There's a level of anxiety that kids experience and parents experience. So I'd purchased some resources for him. So he went, took the test. We used to call it NJASK. Rich would recall those days in New Jersey when we used to call it NJASK. So he came back from the test. I asked him, so how did you do? He said, Dad, I did well, but the stuff that you got me was useless. And why? So he said, the real test didn't look anything like what I had practiced. I'm like, yeah, I get that. It just so happened I was having dinner with his teacher, Mr. Applegate, a couple of weeks later at a PTA. And so I asked Mr. Applegate, you know, this is a problem. Are there any other resources that you're aware of that I could give him so that he would feel more confident and prepared before going for this taste test? And Mr. Applegate smiled at me and said, I know. We don't have anything that mimics the New Jersey test. So I kind of half jokingly said, look, Mr. Applegate, you've seen this test over and over again. Would you mind putting together a couple of practice tests that look like the state test? And he agreed. So I, you know, I have, as you pointed out, some tech background. So I was able to take those two third grade math practice tests that he put together and just made it available on a very simple website, free of charge to all of our community members and said, look, we found this helpful. And if you want it, It's here for you to use. And weeks later, word of mouth, parents started recognizing us and saying, look, we found your practice test useful. Are you going to have language arts? So that's really how we got started. This was a very personal problem, something that I deeply cared about. And yeah, here we are today. We are blessed to be able to help kids in all 50 states, over 1.6 million students.
I'm sure on some level your son reminds you that it was him that really brought this idea to the forefront for you every once in a while.
Indeed, it's been a very beautiful journey for me, Scott. last year, you know, my son now is a lawyer, and he kind of got bored of the work that he was doing as a lawyer at a, you know, firm that he was with. And he said, Dad, can I come work with you guys? So for the past 6 months, he's been working with us. So it's been a very meaningful journey to see him kind of grow up and the work that we do, scaling, and he having an opportunity to come back and participate.
Mm-hmm. Rich, turning to you, when I was looking through your background, you were an award-winning teacher, you were a principal, you were a superintendent, and held some other administrative positions in various districts, I think mostly in the New Jersey area, but maybe there were others as well. Can you kind of talk about your journey as an educator and how you ended up, you know, being part of Lumos?
Sure. Well, my journey as an educator actually started not in education. So my undergraduate degree at Ohio State was in broadcast journalism, and I was interested in working in sports. When I came back to New Jersey after college, I was working at WFAN, which is the New York radio sports station, doing some marketing and promotions, but I was coaching high school sports in New Jersey. So it really, those two things did not go together. in terms of schedule and commutes back and forth and so on. So at that point, my mom had suggested, well, if you love coaching, why don't you see if you like teaching? So I started substituting in the school that I went to. My first day ever was in a kindergarten classroom, and I loved it. And so at that point, I just kind of changed my route, and that's how I ended up in education. From there, immediately went back, got my master's, immediately followed up and, you know, got my doctorate. So I was in school for a good 35 years of my life in that sense. But so then, you know, my trajectory kind of changed, moved into administrative roles and spent over 20 years in that. And then a couple of years ago when I left the schools and actually relocated from New Jersey to North Carolina, which is where I am now, was looking to latch on with some company where I can still contribute and use my expertise to impact schools and impact students in a way that, you know, would certainly help them improve their learning and their experiences. And Mukunda and I connected, and that was it.
So sticking with you, when I opened the show, you know, I did a very quick run through of some of the history behind how assessment exams, you know, have been used. And it's a long history. It's been something that, you know, has become part of politics, part of campaigns, both at the national and the state level. It's not going to go away, and it probably shouldn't go away for various reasons. As a superintendent, when you were either a superintendent or even a principal for that matter, you had to deal with this sort of on a yearly basis. What's it like when you're sitting in the superintendent chair, you get your test results back for the year from the state, and you start thinking about, wow, we really have to work on something? What's that process like, and what does it feel like?
Well, I think you have to back up and kind of look at how are we determining whether or not our schools are effective? Mm-hmm. Because those test scores, you're right, they're not going anywhere, and for whatever reasons, and we could probably do a whole separate show on that. But they are one measure of the success and effectiveness of a school. So, you know, you're always looking at your internal diagnostics and what kind of results we're seeing, whether it be student grades or other local assessments that a district is using. And then there's other factors that make for effective schools: student attendance, staff attendance, behavior, participation in clubs and sports and activities, and all those kinds of things. So when you get those test results back, it's not, you know, again, if this is the kind of environment that you're cultivating in your school district, it's not a panic time. It's not you know, it doesn't have to be an overly anxious time, because it's, okay, here's one additional way that we're deciding, you know, how are we effective and determining what our priorities are going to be moving forward. So it's really all about how you look at it. But when you get those back, yeah, I mean, it matters. They're published and they're seen by the public and, you know, all of those kinds of things. But if you're delivering the message on a consistent basis that, hey, you know, this is just one way that we look at our effectiveness, then it just becomes another tool that you have for your school.
Yeah, it's really interesting in the state of Ohio. So I have a daughter that teaches middle school, and so I kind of see it from different angles. But in the state of Ohio, of course, you know, we have the state tests. But Governor DeWine has also been very upfront about pushing the science of reading. And then most recently in the State of the State address, he talked about attendance as being, you know, very important. And of course, when the governor highlights issues like that, those all of a sudden become important for every district. And for obvious reasons, they start paying more attention to that. Mukunda, when I was looking at the website for Lumos, one of the things that struck me is that in many places on the website, it talks about you all creating an intersection between technology and empathy. And the word empathy is not something that you usually see used in an ed tech website. Can you kind of talk about why that word is so important to what it is that you all are producing for students and teachers?
Thank you for noticing that. And it means a lot to us as a team. So we, if you look at our team, we are primarily teachers, parents, and engineers that deeply care about how we could help a teacher or a kid in a classroom. And in fact, in terms of purpose, we kind of see our platform being a tool that's available to students when a parent or teacher is not with them. So for us to do this job well, I think we truly have to kind of be there when that student needs that extra help. And how do we do that? So kind of over the years, we've been evolving and learning and adapting, building supports to serve that purpose. I mean, you can think about, you know, if you fast forward to today's time, AI is something that we talk about a lot, right? And for me, AI is an enabling tool that actually helps us build empathy. So over the last couple of years, we've been actively building support systems that leverage AI to provide language support. Now, some of the earlier work that people had done in terms of how do we create that personalized support system for every child, it did not have the kind of sophistication that you would want to have. Like if a teacher were to sit next to a kid and trying to help, hey, look, there's a problem in fractions, and how we observe, empathize, and help them in each step of the process. The thing that's exciting to me personally is how AI can do some of that, because we have teacher shortages. We don't have teachers that can actually spend half hour, 45 minutes a day with each kid throughout the school year. These are not scalable ideas. If you look at, for example, the investments that happened over the last 4 or 5 years in education, a lot of that actually was around providing that one-on-one support through tutoring. And the research and the data clearly shows that that works, but it's very expensive, not scalable, you know. And it's very difficult to do. If you're spending, you know, $40, $50 an hour for each child to get that support, no amount of investment can support it. So for us, we constantly ask ourselves, how can we provide that empathic support for students when they're learning math, reading something, or trying to write, or any learning activity? Can some of these tools provide the support that they need? And for us to do a good job, I think the engineers, the teachers, the team that puts this and helps a school use the program, we have to really empathize with the situation that a student is experiencing, the challenges that a teacher experiences in a classroom that's so challenging and busy.
Kind of keeping with this, Rich, when you've observed students in your districts, in schools, going through these tests, and there's a certain grade that comes back, or you know, a certain assessment result, you know, there could be an assumption, okay, if there was a score that wasn't where you wanted it to be, that could be the teacher. But my guess is that you've been able to observe that there's a lot of factors that goes into what it is that could impact how a student does on a particular assessment exam. The empathy issue that Mukunda is talking about sort obviously relates to this, but shouldn't there also be a lot of other factors that, you know, could impact this and then making the test preparation even that much more important for a student?
There are. And I love that you say that, because one of the things that I've always said is that the scores, you know, when these scores come back, they're not just a reflection of the students, they're a reflection of us and our school system and the choices and decisions that we're making and whether or not we're setting students up for success, mm-hmm. you know, and that's always a phrase that I kind of like to use, that like, it's our job to set students up for success. So when you talk about, you know, preparedness and readiness, well, I, you know, before I mentioned the measure of school effectiveness is student participation in sports or the arts. Well, you go to practice. Mm-hmm. If you are, you know, if you're in athletics, you go to practice to prepare for the game. You go to rehearsals if you're in the school play, or if you're, you know, in a musical ensemble, you rehearse so that when you perform, you're ready to go. So it's the same idea here of making sure that we set students up for success and we're preparing. You know, I know there's always this connotation around teaching to the test as a negative phrase, but is it really teaching to the test, or are we just preparing students for success? Are we preparing them for the performance of where we're going to find out what they really know? Because as you said, there's all these other variables that do affect them. So we need to make curricular decisions, instructional decisions. But then in terms of the actual test itself, it's the navigation, you know, mm-hmm. online. Like you don't want students for the first time when they take this test, or even, you know, once a year, they see all of this navigation of the math tools that are in there and the types of questions where you have to drag and drop and you have to use drop down menus and you need to highlight and there's a scratch pad and there's a lot in there.
Yeah.
And just kind of finding your way is not the easiest thing. So, you know, practicing that is preparing students for success. And when the time comes, they're not distracted and they're ready to focus on the content and really what the test should be trying to assess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember back when, you know, in the late 1980s when I was in high school preparing for the SAT, ACT, there were the booklets, the Barron's and US uh-huh. News that you would buy. And there would be little approximation between that and the actual exam when you actually sat down for it. Mukunda, you know, when I looked through the website, one of the things that stuck out to me is that you do have a free diagnostic test tool. And when I was playing around with that, you literally have by state, you know, different versions of practice tests that students can take. It struck me that it's sort of odd that there are so many different variants of tests that happens around the country. That has to be very challenging then for there to, you know, it has to be challenging, you know, for students and teachers to really zero in on what they need to do, because there are so many, if you just Google it, there's going to be so many different versions of exams out there that may or may not be relevant to what you actually practice. So what is it that you try to do with the tools you provide students to make them more comfortable with the actual setting that Rich is describing when they sit for the exam?
That's a great observation, Scott. In fact, it relates to something that you said a little earlier in our conversation today about the evolution of testing over the last 2-3 decades and policy decisions. There was like essentially a convergence of saying, as a country, we're going to have common standards, the common core, common assessments. From that to now, each state having their own priorities around how do you want to assess student progress. And so you're absolutely right. Today, you know, between 50 states, there are about 40 different state tests. Florida's assessment looks very different compared to New York's NYSD, and you know, what happens in Maryland is going to be significantly different compared to Ohio's OST. And that is a challenge for us. You're absolutely right. Because now the challenge is we want to provide that simulation for students when they come to the platform, right? Like Rich pointed out, a student that has seen the test in terms of its look and feel, the items, how to navigate. There is research that actually shows that those kids that have familiarity are going to perform at 6 percentage points higher than kids that are going to experience the test for the first time, that have no clue what the Ohio test is going to look like. So our one of our primary goals is how do we simulate the state test? And you're absolutely right. For us to do this in all the different states, we have to carefully study those blueprints, create an environment that closely approximates what they're actually going to experience on the day of the test. And that means you have to support those item types, the look and feel, the navigation, the accommodations that they're going to have, whether it's a scratch pad or like some states, for example, like Alabama, they provide a protractor for their fourth grade kids when they're trying to answer certain questions. So one of our customers there, she said, oh, I'm not seeing protractor. So we went to work and we built a protractor support. And this is what keeps us busy. You know, we have to keep up with the policy changes, the assessment changes. And also, one of the things that I've noticed over the last several years is even within a state, based on the leadership and the goals that the State Department of Education has, they have made significant changes. Like in Georgia, like over the last year or so, they completely implemented a new curriculum, brand new assessment, right? So for us, it just definitely keeps us on our toes. And, you know, we have to work to align our program so that it looks like the Georgia test or the Ohio test. So that's really where we provide that support. So when a student experiences our program, he feels confident that, hey, I've seen this. In fact, in Ohio, you have the test going on this week. So when those kids go take it, like if it's something that they've seen throughout the school year, they're like, oh, I got this. They feel so much more confident and their achievement levels go up.
You mentioned earlier that you as a company have been working on how AI integrates into this experience for students in a conceptual sense. How is it that AI is making your platform and then the subsequent tests, how does it make the student experience as they're simulating these exams have added value?
So AI has been such a game changer, and as we are seeing as a society, it's going to touch everything that we do. And when it comes to using this technology in the classroom, and when we put this in the hands of a student, there are several challenges too. You know, how do you handle all the other things that you could do if you give somebody, you know, just direct access to Gemini or ChatGPT? That can go in any number of ways. It just based on the student's interest and what they're looking to do. So in our context, we said, let's build a support that is built on AI that has guardrails. So the guardrails for me are data privacy. You know, you want to make sure that you put it for use with a very specific purpose in mind. So in this context, we don't want an AI that can answer all the questions about economy to, you know, history to everything else. We have a very specific purpose. I'm preparing for my Ohio State test. I want to provide the support with this in mind. So if a student, most kids are creative, if they ask questions that are unrelated, then it brings them back. So our kind of use case, which we're so thrilled about, is number one, the student's standards mastery is a very important part. Often, after a student completes a diagnostic test, you see that, oh, John is struggling in four standards. He needs to work on fractions, maybe multiplication, something else. So this application of AI helps us build that learning journey that's highly personalized. And what's more, it is very empathic when it comes to looking at his responses. So let's say you have a multi-step problem in math that you're trying to answer. So most systems before AI would simply tell you that, hey, you got this wrong. Here's the right answer. That is not very conducive for student learning, right? If you are with a good teacher, you're going to nudge them and say, look, you are halfway there. You figured out that to figure out the area of a rectangle, you need to multiply the length and width. And I see that you made a mistake here, or you need to just check your arithmetic when you completed your calculation. So the AI's maturity is so good now, it's able to provide that personalized support instead of revealing the right answer, saying the answer to this question is blah, and here's the detailed explanation. It instead is really supporting them, meeting them where they are without providing the answer, which is, in my personal belief, is a great use of AI because it helps learning.
I appreciate that. And I think that as I'm seeing AI get integrated into higher ed classrooms, which of course I'm more familiar with, it is very much more of how it becomes a adaptive learning tool for students rather than a crutch for quick, you know, answers. And that's where I'm seeing the most exciting use, at least in my college. In communication, Rich, since you have a background in it, of course, AI is starting to influence a lot of the daily workflow practices that we would normally do as communicators, and not having that become a crutch where it does the work for you is a threshold, as you said, Mukunda, that you don't want to cross. But yet at the same time, it's a very incredibly powerful brainstorming tool, a creative tool. So I appreciate everything that you said. Rich, turning back to you, one of the things I really appreciated about an answer that you gave just a few minutes ago is that when you're sitting in the superintendent chair, there's a lot of things that you need to pay attention to that is sort of health indicators of what's going on in your district. So let's not lose sight of that. But let's say that you're in a district where, as the superintendent, you're looking at what's happening in a year and you say, okay, we're not horrible, but I think that our test scores could get better. And we need to start to on-ramp some sort of a strategy that addresses that is more than just superficial. What's the advice you would give them? I mean, obviously your company has a tool to do that, but a tool is not a strategy. So what's the strategy that you would undertake as a superintendent if you said, we need to increase our test scores by a certain percentage in order to do what I know we're able to do?
The first thing is to identify what are those scores that actually need to increase. Because you can throw in generic tools, but if you don't know what the problem is that you're actually trying to solve, then maybe you get lucky and you know, it's treated well and then things change, but in all likelihood not. So it's really about looking at the data that you have and making sense of it. You know, but that's what so with the AI conversation that just occurred, my thoughts were about the power of AI for really helping schools get better at analyzing data and understanding exactly where those issues are. I've been in so many conversations, and I know schools have changed and have gotten much better over the years for the most part, but not every school and every district has. And, you know, sometimes they'll just look at scores and say, well, our math scores need to improve. Well, that's a really open-ended statement. So we're going to improve math, you know, and kind of like with your question. So you have to improve those scores. What do you do? Well, you start with, what does that mean? Well, I'll just make up numbers, you know, only 25% of our students pass the math test. Okay. So, you know, 75% didn't. We need to get those 75% up. Well, 25% did. So what's different about the 25% who did versus the 75% who didn't? And you start to look at those kinds of things and find some, you know, what are those commonalities that could be replicated for other students? Then look at the students who didn't. Because sometimes you'll hear people say our special education scores are poor or our multilingual learner scores are poor. Well, what's poor? Some of those students are doing well. Why are some of those students doing well? And what's different about them than the students who are not? So you really need to keep asking who and what on and on and on until you finally can kind of drill down and identify exactly what those issues are. You know, just as an example, and you know, in districts where I've worked, like we've identified, it was students who were part of more than one subgroup. So it wasn't necessarily a multilingual learner issue or a special ed issue, but it's students who were in those subgroups, but are also economically disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now we're seeing, okay, these are the students to target. We found another pattern, which was really interesting, where it was students who were in our school district for less than 3 years, significantly underperformed the students who were there for their whole education. because they're coming in from different places. They may have even had interrupted education. So, you know, there's so many different variables, kind of talking about what we were about before on all these factors. So the first thing you need to do in terms of coming up, how do we do this, is what is it exactly that we're trying to improve? Then you can target those students and those areas where, you know, which are the specific, because the next part is which part of those scores is it? Because it's not just math. There's a lot of different indicators that go into creating a math score. So are we looking at all of those and really figuring out which it are? So you could change your curriculum. You could change the way that you're grouping students. You could do so many different things, but you have to identify first, what is it that we're trying to improve? And then once you do that, now you can put those plans in place, but you do it in a much more educated way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it gets to really targeting what it is that you're trying to treat.
Mukunda, similar version of that question, but I've done everything that Rich just described. So as the superintendent, I've went through this analysis. I know that there are things that I want to do based upon the data that I think would benefit the district in terms of its assessment scores. I contact you. How do you all at Lumos sort of account for the fact that districts within a district has so many different types of students, as Rich said, that would range in different intersections of backgrounds that could be impacting this, let alone the fact that within a given even county in a state like Ohio, there might be very different districts that are contiguous to one another, but because of just the way the population shifts happens, they're very different in the way that they are able to have resources, the type of students that go there, et cetera. So it's a complex situation. How does the district start to onboard with the solutions that you provide in a way that you know has a positive effect on what it is that they'll be able to get from the experience with you?
So one is the data. Fortunately, a lot of this data is publicly available. So one of the things that we've done over the years is using analytics to really get insights into the data for individual schools. Like Rich said, not every school has the bandwidth to take the time to analyze what the numbers are telling us. Like, it's one thing to say, hey, look, our school has a very poor ranking, but are you able to tell what are the groups or classrooms that actually did well, groups that are struggling, and specifically what standards? And you have, like, if you look at most state assessments today, you're going to get a report that puts them in either a 4 or 5 level scorecard, right? So this is one of the areas where AI has been really helpful for us. We actually have built scorecard for every school in the country, over 100,000. And what we did, we applied AI to the data set that's available. So we understand administrators and teachers may not have the time to sit and go through all the elements of this data. So we pulled AI to work on it. So it provides dashboards and narratives that can actually pinpoint and say, look, you're fourth graders in this particular campus, in this particular section, are the ones that are actually struggling, and they're struggling in these standards. So the first part of it is, how do we really understand the data from not only this year's work, but also previous year's data? Because it gets richer as you have like year one, year two, year three, you can actually see how a school is progressing. Mm-hmm. And that often tells you a story. Like we have seen, for example, one of my personal experiences was to see how like the COVID impacted in terms of student outcomes. You could see a progressive deterioration, like a kid that was in third grade during the COVID years. As he progressed, there was a very noticeable drop. And as you know, learning, it accumulates, and these learning gaps also accumulate and just grows over a period of time. Those are the types of insights that the data and AI can provide in this context. And the second part of what we do is when a school starts working with us, we prefer to work with them throughout the school year, but many schools have other things planned typically for the beginning of the year. They typically could, you know, reach out to us around January, February. But so we created a flexible way for them to onboard. And the recommendation that we have is, hey, start with a clear mindset that testing is not an afterthought. Don't look at testing as the problem you need to solve at the end of the school year. It is a powerful tool that actually can guide instruction. So if you think about how a school year evolves, kids come back from summer, you know, 3 years of not doing anything, you know, 3 months of being away and, you know, playing around in the sun. They typically lose about 6 to 8 weeks of learning. So on day one in August or September, when they come back to school, you are working with a fourth grader who has forgotten most of what he learned in this past school year. So our recommendation is start there, because you can start by giving them the support that they need, help them catch up. So starting from a tool perspective, we've offered them a back-to-school assessment that is actually measuring the student learning loss over the summer. And then it creates a personalized learning path for each student. So the idea here is, if you have them have that warm start, help them recall, regain some of that skills mastery. Ideally, a good school should also recommend some type of summer activity, summer learning, so that you minimize this in the first place. And then throughout the school year, so you're in the first quarter, we have seen tremendous success in classrooms where a teacher thoughtfully bakes test preparation. I would hate to even call it test preparation. It's the elements of testing that is similar to what you're going to see at the end of the year through a warm-up, through an exit ticket. And because that helps guide her instruction. And also, kids would not look at assessment as an end of year or a benchmarking activity. They see it as, oh, every day I go to school, I have to demonstrate my progress, and my teacher uses that in a constructive way to guide the instruction. Right? So we built the program in such a way that a teacher could use it through many diagnostics or warm-ups in a classroom, get real-time feedback to drive her instruction. And of course, the other part of what we do is we simulate the state test. So typically we recommend around January, February, they administer the first full-length practice test. Now here, the intent is, like Rich was talking about, you're getting ready for the game day.
Yeah.
You want to feel that, build the stamina, build the confidence, build the familiarity with what they're going to experience in the spring. So when they do that, two things happen. Once they are getting used to the navigation, the tools. And the second part of it is they also demonstrate their competence. How is John doing in a particular standard, right? So at the end of that, he gets feedback that's personalized saying, look, you need to work on these three standards. And here's a learning path. That intervention follows that practice test. And so the kind of, this is a virtuous cycle. For example, I was talking, you know, we were working with PS115, New York City schools, Principal Consegra and his assistant principal, Nicole Carfioro. You know, they had an amazing outcome. They saw a 70% improvement. So their school was, they saw a 17-point improvement between 2024-25 and 25-26. And so we were very intrigued by, hey, you know, we don't see that kind of a dramatic growth in every school that we work with. So we were talking to Principal Consegra and asked him, and he said, look, we just used it throughout the school year. And we allowed our students to go through the program, carved out slots in our curriculum so that, you know, they had the opportunity to you know, work through those standards where they need it. And the teachers took an active part in assigning activities that was supporting, you know, addressing any gaps that they found in the student achievement. And so we were thrilled to see that some simple ideas like what we were discussing could have such a huge impact.
It's interesting. I like the way you describe it and the rhythm of an academic year. I think that when you use the phrase high stakes testing, it of course places a very particular connotation on top of what is going on. Another side of that coin is if you're using assessment well, it's an incredible tool for the teacher, the students, the families, you know, to sort of be able to understand what the areas are that needs additional attention. I love your analogy, Rich, of sports. I mean, I have some coaching in my life too. And, you know, if you have a player that is having trouble in a game, not making a pass well in basketball, you know, you have to work on that as a coach, right? And that's through assessment, but you obviously ideally are able to diagnose that in practice before they actually get into a game and correct it before that happens. And what you're describing, Mukunda, is very much that, where the teacher could be able to use this tool to identify places where she or he would want to emphasize, either for individual students or for an entire class, areas for improvement. So I really appreciate that. I think the last question that I have, so for listeners and viewers of the podcast, we will have a link to the Lumos website so that you can take a look at it. And as I mentioned, there are some abilities for you to go in and look at free diagnostic tools to see what it's like. So I would encourage you to take a look at the website. The data is very impressive in terms of, you know, what you've been able to achieve with individual districts and overall. Have you seen evidence? My last question is about sort of the effectiveness. Have you seen evidence, because you've been around since 2007 in some version or another, have you seen evidence that when students start with your solution at an early age and then progress with it as they progress through and matriculate through their, you know, different grade levels, is there sort of an accumulative effect of success? As I think about, athletics, for example, if a student sticks with a sport over the course of, you know, third grade through 12th grade, they do get better at it each year because they're practicing it over and over and over again. Do you see the same effect with test taking when there's intentionality from the school on helping the students be familiar with the test and to sort of attack the test rather than be reactive to it?
Yeah, absolutely, Scott. That self-determination theory talks about this, and it's been research that's been going on for decades, and one of the core beliefs that we have, and one of the element of that which we have applied very closely to assessments is really autonomy. And really, when you have a child that feels that sense of I can do it, it's in my control, as opposed to someone that is driven by fight or flight kind of response to a test. And that's a very cumulative thing as well, right? Number one, once they get a handle on it, feel like, oh, I got this, I am ready for it. Also, I can improve myself. And in fact, we were working with a school recently. They were using it for their after-school tutoring program. And the kids there, I had an opportunity to speak with these amazing third graders, fourth graders, and middle schoolers. The things that these kids see was just fascinating to me. They were telling us what we need to change in the program from, hey, look, can you make it a game? I want to kind of get a sense of how I'm doing, to one of the girls. In fact, she had something even more insightful. She said, if you're going to create that game, are you going to show the scores of my score and everyone else's? Because she was worried that she would feel threatened by some kid being, you know, shown their performance. The reason I bring that is kids love to succeed. We don't realize it, but once they feel empowered, once they have the sense of autonomy, and feel like they can see that growth, they will tell us what to do. They'll be very engaged, even in a test preparation program, which is not, you know, like playing an EY game. When they realize that this leads to their growth and they feel it, they're going to be on board, and you will see that impact in their, you know, achievement levels as well.
Thank you for that explanation. Rich, the last question that I have for you, again, putting your superintendent hat on, obviously staff buy-in on something like this is critically important. And, you know, if you're sitting in the chair of the superintendent and you decide, okay, we're going to, you know, partner with Lumos and we are going to work on, amongst many other things, we're going to work on, you know, getting students ready for the exams, the assessment exams. What are some of the strategies that you might use as a superintendent to sort of help propel that buy-in so that teachers are not viewing that, as you said, as teaching to the test and, you know, something that's detracting from their ability to, you know, be creative with their students?
Yeah. Well, I think the key first is that there's a reason for it. There's a reason that we're doing this. And that, you know, that applies to any new initiative that you're going to bring into a school district. It can't just be because it looks good on paper and it's going to sound great when we tell everyone that we're, you know, we're doing this. And that does happen. So there needs to first be a real valid reason. Here's the issue we're trying to solve. Our kids are not as prepared as they could be. So we need to change our structure and our system, because the student's performance is also a reflection of us. And if there's a tool that's available that can help us help our students better succeed, then, you know, it only makes sense for us to use that. So it's sort of starting there. But then there is some training that's involved in that. And, you know, I believe that professional, just as we talk about individualizing for students and using the data to help students and making sure that they're supported, we need to do the same for teachers. Like, everything that we expect teachers to do for students, well, as in leadership roles, we should be doing those same things for teachers. So setting them up for success, making sure they understand, here's the vision. This is why we're using this. This is how it's going to be implemented. This is what your role looks like. This is how we'll make sure that you're prepared to implement it in the way that we're going to do together. Here's how we're going to assess its effectiveness or not. And then, you know, how we'll make adjustments based on that information. So as long as we're walking through that together, and it's not, we're doing this because your teaching is subpar, and as a result, we need to find another way for students to succeed. Like, that's not the message. Yeah. The message is, hey, here's another tool to help you help your students find success. And I'm going to be here, or, you know, we are our leadership team to support you through that. And then that's the plan. It's all about being together. It's not a, you know, administrative for, you know, versus teacher adversarial relationship. It's one of, we're in this together to help our students. We have the same vision, the same desired outcomes, and that's how it goes. And then, you know, like Mukunda said, the key is, because schools do this too. Some schools shut down 6 weeks before testing and do nothing but, all right, now it's time. That's not the right way to do it. The way to do this is to naturally integrate it into the daily life for the students. So when they show up during test week, it's just business as usual.
Yeah.
It's just, this is what we do. I'm ready for this. And, you know, there's no running around. There's no chaos. We're calm. We're confident. We're ready to go.
Yeah. Very good. Guys, it's been great getting to meet both of you. It's nice that we have somewhat of a Ohio connection between the three of us. Thank you for describing, you know, the thought process behind what it is that you're providing as solutions to districts, but also the broader conversation of just how you need to be intentional in getting students ready for these exams. They are important. They're not going to go away. They can serve very good purposes for districts. And I appreciate the opportunity to learn more about Lumos and how it can help districts, you know, get the students ready for taking those exams and performing at the highest level possible. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott. Really appreciate you giving us this opportunity. And I love your podcast and how you shed light on so many topics every week. They're so critical and really helps educators around the country.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate the conversation. Certainly enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for the shout out on the podcast. It's a labor of love on my part, on top of the day job, but it's always really interesting. And I think that, you know, learning about, you know, AI is a big topic of conversation, obviously, in nearly every podcast that I do right now. And that's for good reason. And I think that, you know, this conversation was about a lot more than just artificial intelligence, but it certainly is always enlightening to see how AI is being used for good purposes in schools, because I think that's one of the things that everyone's struggling with about, you know, how to actually implement it effectively and where are the wins. And it's nice to see that you all are figuring that out with ideas like empathy undergirding what it is that you're doing. I think that's so important. So my guests today have been Mukunda Krishnaswamy and also Rich Katz. Both of them are with Lumos Learning. The website for Lumos will be in the text accompanying the podcast if you would like to learn more about the solutions that they provide and how, and also, as I said, there's an opportunity for you to take a free diagnostic test if you would like to delve deeply into what is it they do. Thank you all for listening and watching Teaching Matters. If you have ideas, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to reach out to us by emailing us at teachingmatterspodcast@ohio.edu. That's all one word and all lowercase. And of course, you can also direct message us on social media. Thanks for listening, and we hope everyone has a great day.